Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from Multispeed Technologies, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open this hour. To be a part of the program, it is a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. That's 1-855-450-6624, or send an email to live@AskNoahShow.com. My name is Noah Chalaya. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah Show kicks off this hour. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Ovens. Welcome in, sir.
Good evening, Noah. How's it going tonight?
It was pretty good, Steve. You're here tonight.
I am here.
Yes, I am. An astute observation. So I had a wild past few weeks. So as I'm sure you're aware, EMS sent out a thing saying that everybody needed to migrate off of their servers. Now, I'll save you the story, long story longer. What I was paying $22 a month through EMS is now costing me roughly $50 a month to get the equivalent service from a hosting provider as we slowly move over into our own infrastructure. And so I had a lot of sleepless nights as we moved all of these Matrix instances over, client Matrix instances, our own Matrix instances, my personal one. And I'm proud to tell you that as of today, with the exception of some media files that need to still get moved over to my personal one, all of it's done. And I'm on the other side and I feel much, much better.
That's a big lift. I imagine you're relieved.
Yeah, it's one of those things like, you know, we talk about not wanting to host email, or at least we've kind of had that fluid discussion. And a big part of that is nobody wants to take critical services and then become responsible for them because it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job. And most of us don't want to sign up for that. And I didn't really want to sign up for this either. I'd much rather have offloaded it to the kind EMS folks, but they didn't want to take my money anymore because, well, it was, I think, costing them more money than I was giving them. So kind of makes some sense. But in any event, I feel much, much better on the other side. And now I feel like I'm way more empowered to do some feedback and give back to the community.
Well, let's do it.
Our first email comes in from Corey. Corey writes in and says, I'm sorry, but people unfairly criticize Ajit Pai. So let's just say my blood is boiling and here's why. That rhymes. He's a poet and he didn't even know it. For one, net neutrality, he made the right call. Alternative was government control of the internet, and no thanks. Secondly, the email compared to U.S. of Japan or other small countries in Europe, it's like comparing apples to Legos. And then he goes in to describe how the differences between the geographical size of Japan and the United States and some of the differences. I would also add to that that I think there's some cultural differences, right? One of the things that if you ever have a chance to visit Japan, one of the things that is absolutely stellar about it is all of the citizens there take tremendous pride in their country, tremendous pride, and they have tremendous self-respect to the point that even those who are arrested still stand at attention, organize their jail cell, eat in a very organized fashion because it's about respect. The homeless people, I know this stuck out to me like a sore thumb. At first I was like, there aren't any homeless people. I can't find them. No, they are there. They live maybe under a bridge, but they take their shoes out and they set them outside of their box because it's a cardboard box and it's under a bridge, but gosh darn it, it's my cardboard box under my bridge and I'm going to take care of it. And so it's just it's a very different attitude that you see in the rest of the world to include the U.S. And then he goes on to talk about why regulation is needed and here's why. And he says, they're actually saying it's less regulations, in which they conclude with their own arguments. Every single time the government steps in free markets and they regulate, there are unintended consequences every single time. There should be some basic laws in place, but otherwise let the free market does what it does best, innovation. And so I think largely, I don't know, I'd be interested in what you think, Steve, but I think largely the tech community, we kind of have, especially the Linux community, has that kind of rebel rousing, anti-authoritarian, buck the system, buck the trend, be different kind of attitude. I don't think any of us are really advocates of government control. I think most of us want to see maximum absence of coercion. I think where some of us diverge from that is maybe when we start to see some problems, like you've pointed out many times. We start out with what starts as a free market or try to, but then sometimes there can be some problems with that, and so what to do then? Which I would draw you back to Ajit's comments that he says it's not about do we or don't we, it's when do we. Your thoughts?
I think largely when I reflect on the Linux community, I think you're correct in terms of being comfortable with going a different path. I think where the divergence is more in what the sense of justice is and how to accomplish that. And I think you can see that just based on the distro wars, right? And when you look at how people approach, oh, well, you shouldn't use this one, you should use that one, it's more from a standpoint of like, this is how the view, like this is how my view of right and wrong in the world fits, and then going after it that way. And how that applies to regulation is you've got people that everybody sees a problem. Just like everybody sees a problem with, let's say, proprietary software. How mm-hmm. we solve that problem, or if the way I phrased it, the way that we view justice is where the community kind of splits. And so it's the same thing with regulation, right? Where people are there, everybody sees the injustice and says, this needs to be fixed. And some people say, okay, well, we need to do it because we have to coerce the people that are not going to do it by their nature. And other people are saying, you know what, if we let the money talk, the people are going to put their money behind the best service, and that will naturally win. Those are kind of vaguely the way things break down. I think largely that's what you're seeing play out in the feedback we've been getting.
Yeah. It helps if I turn my microphone on. 100%. I'll be interested to see what the long-term ramifications of the internet are. You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking about this a few weeks ago. My wife and I were having a talk about the social ramifications of the internet, right? And one of the things that her and I both agreed on is we kind of came to this conclusion that, you know, a lot of times in society, when you make a change, it's slow. It happens over decades. And so there's time to adjust. And one generation isn't necessarily responsible for the entire shift, right? One generation takes it a little bit, another generation takes it a little bit further, so on and so forth. The internet's a unique beast, right? Because when I was a kid, it didn't exist. I mean, it existed, but it was in such its infancy form that nobody relied on it. Nobody considered it critical. It was a luxury that a few people had. And in my lifetime, I've watched it go from that to today. If you want to get city council meetings, if you want to pay your water bill, if you want to pay your power bill, if you want to sign up for new service, like, you have to have the internet. And so watching that shift happen, and then in a comparatively very short amount of time, of course that leads to a tremendous amount of challenges, because regulation just doesn't move as fast as technology does. And so I think there's a natural propensity to have some problems we wouldn't ordinarily have.
I think that I think in part that's true, but at least in terms of when we're watching specifically the internet, I think you can call that a generation, because your kids now exist in the world. So that you have a different generation that is growing up with the internet. And I think that in particular is the definition of a generation. You have a kid, and by the time that they're in their adulthood and having their own kids and well on their way with their own kids, I think you can call that a generation. It doesn't mean that a generation doesn't mean that one section has to have completely died off before something new has happened. Like, if you look at social movements or anything else like that, 20 or 30 years is about the point where a radical shift of adoption may have happened. So,
okay, let me try this on for size then. How about we take us back to the 1930s, 1940s. You have virtually, if the kind of communication that exists is you walk into a radio telephone operator and tell them what you want to say, they use spark to turn a signal on and off to be able to through Morse code, communicate a message and the other person is received. So it's largely disconnected from the end user, right? I just tell you what I want, and then through this magic of technology, somehow it happens and comes out the other side. We went from that to television, where you had screens in front of you. Before we could even fully ascertain the ramifications, both positive and negative, of television, you then have the internet and more screens coming out. And so as the research is catching up and we're going, man, there are some real problems with sitting in front of a screen all day. There's some real developmental problems when you park your kid in front of the free babysitter, so to speak, and let it raise your kids for you a little bit. We're just now learning some of those things, and yet, as you correctly pointed out, we're now two generations in. I grew up with TV was around before I was born, and it has existed my entire life, and now my kids' computers have been in front of their faces from the entire time they're born. So it's just that clip rate seems to be gaining steam, and with that, I think that we get information maybe more delayed than would be ideal. I don't know. Am I onto something, or am I grasping at straws?
I think that I could buy part of that argument. I'd say that reading homework for anybody that's interested, go read The Master Switch.
Yeah,
that'll really open your eyes in terms of, this wasn't meant to be a history lesson. Noah and I are just kind of going off the cuff here, but they talk about how when the screens were introduced, particularly TV, for example, regulation was used in order to maintain the what was seen as the moral good at the time. And so even though we didn't have all of these studies to tell you about what was right and what was wrong in terms of like how it affects us, it affects your brain, there people had an inkling of the fact that, you know what, maybe we should constrain this at least from a moralistic standpoint. And I think that we've lost our way as a society because when we adopted a plurality, we no longer have a distinct moral compass. That doesn't mean that I'm saying we're immoral, but when you roll back, whenever you have a large homogenization of a culture, they generally have a moral compass that is pointing a direction, right or wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And because of that, they can make certain judgments, and you'll see that policies will crop up because of that, that will help maintain that guiding compass. Now that we have a large plurality of different cultures and different mindsets from, very diverse backgrounds, there's no more moral compass. And all of these things, we've reverted to a Wild West because society as a whole isn't pulling in the same direction anymore. And I think that's, I would agree with you in terms of what you were saying with, hey, things are moving fast and it's hard for us to keep up. My addendum to that would be things are moving fast, but we no longer have a singular direction that we're looking in. That's why it feels like we can't keep up.
That's fair. You know, it'll be interesting as the rest of this episode rolls on, as we talk a little bit about value systems and how to incorporate and or jettison those value systems from technology. Joe writes in and says, hi, show. Jake, that's a new one. Hi, show. That must be Noah and Steve, except you can do it in four letters instead of Noah's. Anyway, hi, show. Django is pretty great, but as somebody who started learning HTML some 20-some years ago, probably more, I found PHP even more accessible. If it helps, I have a lot of tutorials for building a simple interface and a UI using PHP. I also really love The Joy of PHP, Alan Forbes. To be honest, the syntax is a bit dated, but for those who use HTML, it makes a lot of sense. And then he provides a couple of links. PHP 8 is pretty great, even though people like to poo-poo it. I think for simple things, it's really approachable because you can use it very granularly, add lines of codes to build something without having to set up a full framework and have a ton of existing assumptions. And while a really powerful, requires a great deal of back-end understanding to connect all of the dots, a pure LAMP server really just lets one step by step and build up. Feel free to pick up the Note Organizer app as well, similar in vein, but around MongoDB rather than MySQL. I tried to detail how to build everything in the training link above. Love the show. Thanks for the content and advice. Steve, your thoughts.
So I think that while this email is fair, I think it misses the point of what you were trying to convey. And you wanted a batteries included type approach, right? Because mm-hmm. part of it was you didn't know exactly what you needed at the time that you started. And so the batteries included approach where I need authentication. Oh, well, here's how you plug that in. If you're doing that with PHP, like he says, it requires a decent amount of backend understanding to connect all the dots together, right? Now, he was specifically meaning the framework itself. I don't agree with that statement, but when you're talking about pure PHP, you would have to understand, how do I connect that into the authentication? How do I connect PHP to the database? How do I write to the database and stuff like that? Whereas a framework like Rails, for example, I know we're talking about Django, but Rails, for example, is the quintessential one where I need to be able to write to a database or do a lot of database stuff. Like, that framework is fantastic for doing database work. Like, it's got all of the stuff that are just kind of, it lightens your load. And so I understand the point. I disagree on the premise of it would have been ideal for you, because you benefit greatly from the framework and not really needing to know all of the intricacies of what you were trying to do. You just needed to know, hey, if I put this line in, now I've got authentication.
Yes, that is precisely what I was looking for. 855-450, no, it's 855-450-6624. The email, live at AskNoahShow.com, or you can join us in the Mumble Room. Naylor from the Mumble Room has a question. Welcome in, sir.
Hey, gentlemen. How's your evening going?
Doing good.
Hey, Naylor.
Hey, I actually have a question and a suggestion. So let's start with the suggestion first. You've been talking about hosting your own email. So Brandon and I have been looking at iRedMail. Have you looked into this one yet?
Yeah, that's what I started with before I was pointed to Mail in a Box. And then I forget the one that Tiny is using. I'll have to touch base with him too. But actually, I think I can pull him in. Tiny, what is the mail server that you've been oops. What is the mail server that you've been using? And why can't I pull him in here? And what do you think of it?
I'm using... I prefer it to iRedMail. It felt more modern when I was using it.
Sorry, you cut out there. What are you using?
MailCow. The domain is mailcow.email. You could buy it hosted from them, or you could self-host it using Docker Compose.
So, yeah. So, I've heard of iRedMail and MailCow.
May I ask why you chose Mail in a Box over iRedMail? Because we found the interface on iRedMail to be... Just stellar for the users.
So my rationale came down to largely really what I'm gearing for here. I want a back end for Nextcloud. I want an email back end for Nextcloud. It's as I go into these businesses and we sell them services, a conversation that is going to play out over and over and over and over again is, oh, a self-hosted Office Suite. Can I open my docs? Yes, you can. Can I open Excel sheets? Yes, you can. Can I open my presentations? Yes, you can. Can I share files? Yes, I can. Can you send an email? No, you can't. Well, you can, but you got to pay for Office 365 anyway, and then you can use that to connect. So, and the thing that's frustrating to me is Mail in a Box uses Nextcloud on the back end to power part of it. So it seems like that could be the perfect way to roll it all together. But you've had some really great success with iRedMail. Tell me what you like about it.
Well, we haven't had great success. We've set it up. We're starting to play with it.
That sounds successful.
We wanted the 2FA and the calendars and contacts baked in, and nothing else seemed to have that. Especially 2FA.
Well, see, now I'm back to Nextcloud. So let's take the 2FA out for just a second.
Okay, so, but hold on. So that means that you are willing to wait until Nextcloud is fully integrated with Mail in a Box before you roll this out?
Not necessarily. So, like, if I was to do it tomorrow, first of all, I want to be abundantly clear with everybody listening. I have not made a decision that I'm jumping into this boat. We're going on month three. I'm done measuring it in weeks. Month three of Microsoft trying to troubleshoot their Office 365 problem to where an organization can't send emails to the entirety of @yahoo.com. And Microsoft just can't seem to figure out how to fix it or what to do about it. And in absence of that, I've started to consider more that, hey, at least with my foot over here in this boat, at least there is something that I could do, even if I don't want to do it. So if I was to do it today, I'd set up Mail in a Box and then tie it to the Round Cube, which is already being run by Nextcloud, or use Nextcloud's built-in mail app, and I could get all the pieces for it today. I think that there's a high potential to integrate the entire thing, so you get the entire kit caboodle. That Nextcloud would absolutely do contacts, it'll do calendars, it'll do file share, it'll do all the things that you would get with a G Suite or an Office 365 subscription, but it would be all open source.
Correct. But right now, no 2FA, right?
I believe that is correct.
Okay. All right.
When you say 2FA, do you mean they are able to access the email client using OIDC?
Well, it means we want a second factor of authentication, not just here's a password and I can log in.
Something you have, something you know.
Is that to a web interface, or is that to, like, I want to use Evolution with iRedmail?
No, he's saying, like, when you go to log in, you go to type in the password, it also prompts you for a YubiKey or an email code or a PIN.
Exactly. Or
a text
or
message.
Text, or something.
At what point are you needing FFA? Is it accessing it from a third-party client or accessing the web interface of iRedmail?
We don't – well, both, actually. We don't want their mail to be compromised, so there needs to be a second factor of authentication to prevent them from – getting compromised because they could just crack their password, because despite the fact that we say you must have this, they change it to that, their dog's name or whatever.
Password 123.
A Gower.
Well, so with Redmail, I could log in with Evolution using MFA?
I don't know. Haven't gone that far.
I have yet to find a self-hosted email solution that supports using a desktop and an MFA. So I was wondering.
But most of our clients are going to want the web interface, and therefore iRedmail is already set up for that.
Have you deployed it anywhere, Naylor, or this is purely just in a testing environment?
Purely just in a testing environment. Brandon wants to completely move over to with one of his emails and start to use it exclusively, and we're going to see how well it works for about a month or two.
See, Brandon and I are in the same boat. So that's been my process. Is I'm starting very, very, very slow, and it's a slow roll. I want to see how it works. I want to see how it connects. I want to see what kind of problems it is. I want to see what happens when there's a problem. That's what I'm really waiting for, and how fast I can get to the resolution, and what that process of resolution looks like. But I don't really, if it's open source, I don't really care what the back end is. I'm not opposed to iRedmail. I just, again, when I look at it, mail in and of itself wouldn't be enough. Like, people won't come just for email. These days, they expect the entire office suite. And when I look at what's available out there, and when I look at how close mail in a box is, I really feel like we're just about there. So, but I'll be interested to follow your endeavor with iRedmail. I'd be interested, of course, to continue to follow Tiny. And see how all these solutions work out, and if one rises to the top, that would certainly take my grab my attention, come top of mind to me. Steve, any of this discussion about email bring it closer to home for you, or are you still in the boat like, nope, I'm not touching that with the 10-foot pole, been there, done that, don't care for it?
Nah, I don't see a reason to go back. Like, I understand if I was supporting clients, I probably would be very much in Naylor's camp. I definitely would be looking the 2FA route as well. Not that Nextcloud doesn't have that, but I personally am not looking to solve this problem anymore. I got bigger fish to fry.
Charlie writes in, says, "G'day everyone. Various podcast bloggers and tech savvy users have talked about the dangers of Ring cameras, smart speakers, and now it turns out, smart vacuums. They're mapping your home and uploading your data. New York Times, Roomba vacuums are mapping your home and collecting your data. At what point I recommend avoiding anything that is A, smart, cloud dependent, always online and can't function offline, or incorporates DRM DLC pay for extra functionality. Is it time to go back to analog and just ditch digital electronic devices, manual locks, old light bulbs, simple twin tub washing machines, old radio transistors? Maybe the Amish had good reasons to reject modern technology push, Charlie." So here's my immediate guttural reaction to that. The technology is supposed to be there for my convenience, okay? I am not a slave to the tech. The tech is a slave to me. So I will not be beaten by the technology. I will not be outsmarted by it, and I won't give in. So I'm not necessarily going to move from my stance of a demand for things not to be cloud, but I'm also not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We can absolutely have all the nice things and have them non-cloud connected. Steve, you've done this with vacuums. How has it worked out for you?
So it's one of those things the average consumer is probably not going to take the time to sort around. But if you are intentional about your purchasing, you can absolutely find smart vacuum cleaners that will fit the bill for you. So we have one in our house, but it had to be locally controlled. And the one that I happen to have is, if you're able to control it over MQTT, which means I plugged it into Home Assistant, of course. And we've 100% tested it without internet connection. And we do, I would say, about 99% without. Yeah. Handy integration. But the Home Assistant integration doesn't do the maintenance checks. So it doesn't tell you, hey, it's time to replace the roller or all of those sorts of things. That's a minor thing. And if that went away tomorrow or they wanted to start charging for use of app, I'd be like, eh, we'll just flip it over and look at it.
Mm-hmm. Do you, is there a particular model? How do you determine which one? So it's a Roomba, right? How do you determine which Roombas can be locally controlled and which ones are not so cloud for, or are not so off cloud? Well, I don't know what you even call it. Self-hosted friendly, non-internet friendly, yeah. Privacy respecting. How do you figure it out?
So the first step for me is always, can I integrate it with Home Assistant? And then from there, what is the Home Assistant integration doing? Because that part of it's open. And if you look at it and say, oh, well, here it's doing a cloud connect, here it's not. And for the official Home Assistant integrations, it'll tell you. They have on the Home Assistant wiki for each integration, they tell you, is it local? Is it polling? Is it cloud? It has a little thing there that tells you about that. So once I find one that is local, and you can start by like doing regular internet searches for, I want a Roomba that is locally controlled only or whatever. And as you pointed out previously, when we've talked about these things in the past, you could even look for ones that can be flashed with other firmware. Now, the caveat to all of this is, just because some Roombas do it doesn't mean all do. And that has 100% been proven by my anecdotal evidence proven, I suppose. I can back that up with anecdotal evidence. How about I say it like that? So you have to be savvy about it.
Are you aware of any third-party manufacturers that make smart vacuums that aren't primarily designed from the standpoint of cloud, where they're designed to be locally controlled? Is there any sort of a Shelly-style device that does vacuums, or is that really, there's the cloud companies and then there's everything else?
I have heard of a few, but I haven't looked into them recently. It's been on my list to do this year because this Roomba is now multiple years old and starting to show signs of breaking down, and I don't know how much it'll be worth trying to repair it. I've heard of them. I can't tell you off the top of my head any of the brands. I'd have to go back and look at some of the stuff that I've kind of filed away for later research.
What are you doing with your smart vacuum? Does it work for you? Are you happy with it? Have you flashed firmware? Do you know of another brand other than Roomba that is open source friendly or self-hosted friendly? Write in live at AskNoahShow.com.
From the Linux Newswire newsroom, this is the Week in Review with JT.
For the week of March 3rd, 2024, here's the Linux and open source news. OpenSUSE has added a new systemd boot integration. Tails 6.0 is out. The KDE 6 update has arrived. GNOME 46 has added variable refresh rate support. GDB version 14.2 has been released to address a few bugs. The video editor Shotcut has been released and is now at version 24.02. Gparted has released version 1.6. DistroBox 1.7 has been released and includes better NVIDIA GPU support and better Wolfie containers. Linux Torvalds has declared Linux 6.8 is probably back on track for a regular release cycle. UbiCloud has stated that they want to build an open source alternative to AWS. And in a disappointing turn of events, AMD's efforts to implement HDMI 2.1 Plus functionality on its Linux graphics driver have been rejected. In security news, threat hunters have discovered a new Linux malware called GTPDOR that's designed to be deployed in telecom networks that are adjacent to GPRS roaming exchanges. And cybersecurity researchers have discovered a new Linux variant of a remote access Trojan called Bifroze that uses a deceptive domain mimicking VMware.
I think this is actually the first time Steve and I met in real life, and we had a fairly in-depth discussion talking about the role of technology, limits on technology, and how to balance it with life. And Steve, I guess I want to start the discussion here. It is incumbent upon anybody who is an expert in the field or anybody who understands something deeply to be a good steward of whatever that thing is. So if you and I are stewards of technology, we understand it, and we become the tech support for, well, this audience for sure, but also just people in our own lives, it's important that we're responsible stewards of that technology. And so I think that can have come with some challenges in the way of, are we applying with intentionality our values to technology, or are we shaping our life around what's convenient and how what technology expects from us? And so I guess one of the first conversations we ever had, you made what I thought to be an absolutely outrageous, preposterous, stupid, uninformed suggestion, to where you said, you know what you should do? You should just shut all your devices off for one day a week. And I thought, this man has absolutely no idea what he's talking about. Like, that would work great if I worked for a corporation where I could just tell my boss, yo, I won't be around for the next day. But that won't work for me. If I did that, I'll lose clients and I'll be poor. And then eventually I'll be living in a homeless shelter and I won't be able to eat. And my kids will be, it'll be terrible, right? And I had this whole thing worked out of why it would never work. Well, 2 years later, Steve, from Friday, 6 o'clock at night until Sunday morning, at the absolute earliest, late Saturday night, I've just been disconnecting, and I've been doing that for about 2 years. And I'll be darned if not only has nothing burned down, my business has grown and is in better shape than it's ever been. I'm way more relaxed and happy. I'm way more invested in my wife and my kids. And I know that I wake up on Sunday and come back into work with way more energy than I had previously. Where did that suggestion come from, and how in the world did you arrive at it?
Well, honestly, it's a practical thing. It's like, it goes back to the old joke. It's like, doctor, when I poke this, it hurts. And the doctor says, then don't poke it. It's one of those things. It seems to me that if something is causing you excess stress, then maybe just stop doing that thing. And now, obviously, that advice doesn't work if you're a doctor or, emergency responder of some sort, like all those caveats out of the way. But knowing Noah and his clientele and the types of work that there is, not to mention the fact that at this point, Noah had staff, right? So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a team.
In the worst case scenario, Noah could have designated somebody to be on call. So it was a low risk thing. It's like, look, here's the deal. Your business is not going to fall apart if you do this for a month and you have all kinds of problems. Like, your business is not going to implode. You could appoint somebody to just pick up the phone and deal with it. And ultimately, it has been my business experience for the last decade or more that when you set up a boundary with a client that is reasonable, and one day a week is a reasonable thing, they will respect you more because you've respected your own time.
That has been exactly my experience. And now I've actually really become a huge proponent of trying to get other people to think about this. You know, largely, I would have never considered myself to be somebody who got burnt out or overly stressed or any of that. I really enjoy it. In fact, I tell people all the time, every once in a while, this conversation will come up. Somebody will go, Noah, I want to get into IT. Why do you want to get into IT, random person? Because I hear that you make $100,000 or more a year and I want to make a bunch of money. And I will tell that person, you should not get into IT. That's the wrong reason. And I said, you can't compete with me, right? Like, if that's what you think you're going to do, show up between 8 and 5 and do what I do, you will fail. And I'm going to be one step ahead of you every time, because when I get done at 5 o'clock, I drive home and then I pick up and get into my home lab and I start picking up all the projects I want to do, because I don't get burnt out. I don't get tired of it. I get energized from it. And so if you want to work in this field, you have to have a passion for it. You have to care about it. And that can be a really difficult thing for people to get their heads around. But as I started to apply some of these principles and some of these ideas of taking time, it's gotten to the point where there's been an ongoing discussion on work-life balance, so to speak. And I wanted to read you that an email that I got that came in. And so there was an emergency situation and it was kind of burning down to the ground. And other team members were kind of poking around, but I was the, you know, as it happens, I was the person that had to move the ball a little bit. And I didn't see the emails because I wasn't checking it on Saturday. And here's the email that one team member sent to everybody else to kind of flesh it out. Noah doesn't work today outside of an emergency. I spoke to him late in the day yesterday, and I know that he reached out to so-and-so, who told him to talk to so-and-so. I know that so-and-so was dealing with something personal, and Noah and I talked about putting this off until Sunday when everybody would have more time. I've not spoken to Noah, but it's my belief that he plans to address it Sunday afternoon or tomorrow. He did bring the thing, and we'll work on the project, and we'll get it complete by tomorrow. Yes. Finally, I believe so-and-so ordered, and then it goes on to, hey, here's the plan. After that email, which I didn't write, team member wrote it to other people. Everybody just accepted. They're like, oh, he doesn't work today. Oh, okay. Well, I guess we'll just wait until tomorrow and then it'll get done. And it did. And what was funny is, had I had to have come in on what I perceived to be my day off at a time when I have designated time for my family and my wife and for personal rejuvenation and kind of resting the soul, had I chosen to do that, I would have been angry about it. I would have been upset about it. I would have felt like I got gypped throughout the week. And the problem probably would have gotten solved, but it wouldn't have gotten solved with the detail and with the effort and with the attitude and with the vigor that it got solved 20, even just 24 hours later. So in the end, the client got a better end result. In the end, everybody else lived without me for 24 hours. And in the end, I fought to fight another day. So Steve and I kind of wanted to bring this up to talk about the idea of work-life balance. So I want to start here, Steve. When you find yourself connected to, because a lot of what both you and I do, the communication is digital, right? And this poses more than one challenge. My biggest thing is I'm a very black and white direct person. So I will tell you exactly what I'm thinking, exactly what I'm thinking. And I don't mean it in a mean way. I don't mean it in a sarcastic way. But when it comes out over text, it can sound very rough because I'm just saying exactly what I think in the moment. I'm not trying to put a filter on it, and I'm not trying to, you know, sugarcoat it or anything. And so that can come off a little bit rough. When you're doing that, or when you're on the receiving end of that and you find yourself becoming frustrated and, hey, oh man, this is just stress inducing, how do you disconnect from that? Because to a degree, you have to be connected. And at the same time, you need to be able to walk away. How do you find yourself doing that?
That's a difficult question. So I find myself having to communicate electronically fairly frequently. And what kind of spurred me on in the last couple of weeks is I had a conversation online with somebody, and the way it went down is like, there was a post and I saw the post and I just replied. I'm like, yeah, you know what? Had the same problem. I ended up giving up. I didn't think much of it. Someone else replied to the post in a way that I felt was antagonistic, essentially saying, well, maybe you're disgruntled because other people have figured this thing out and you didn't. And that really kind of set me off, but I walked away because I don't do these things on my phone. It was my desktop. I literally turned the light off in the office, closed the door, and I walked away. Like, I can't respond to this right now. And sometimes that is the best approach you can take, because while I did end up responding to the particular post, I was able to have a different clarity of response. And sometimes leaving those things hang like that, if it wasn't a post, like if it was an email or something like that, allowing that person to have the last word may be the best approach, even though honestly, it bites at my ego to allow something like that to stand. And even that choice of words indicates how I feel about that, right? Like, you know, this cannot stand. That's the way that I feel in my brain. But at the end of the day, like, let the person have that, and it's challenging. It is a challenging thing for me because I find myself in a position every day at work where I'm expected to speak with authority. And when I let something go like that, it is a difficult exercise for me to not engage further. Like I in this particular case, I replied and then they replied. And I thought, you know what? I went and complained to my wife, like, I can't, like, this is really irritating to me. And that's where it went. I didn't end up perpetuating that. sometimes you can get away with that, right? And sometimes the best thing, so when I've had this conflict with clients, what I will actually do is I'll have a sidebar with somebody else at Red Hat and like, can you please send like an intermediary response? Because usually there's a project manager or there's an account manager or there's someone that I can talk to that, you know.
Push it off on the sales guy. I see how it is.
Well, no, not push it off on the sales guy. Like, they don't have to necessarily respond for me, but respond so that the client doesn't feel like they're being ignored.
Yeah.
Right? But at the same time, it buys me a good amount of time to be able to like depressurize myself. And so far, I have been successful in this approach. I can think of one time at Red Hat where I was not successful in communicating with a colleague, a coworker, and that escalated. So I'd say, you know, one time out of 8 years is not too bad considering the amount of conflict that I may generate with my personality.
Boy, I'd say. So I guess here's my takeaway as I hear you describe that. My first takeaway is you know where the power button is and you're not afraid to use it. And I think that's something that all of us would benefit from, right? At the end of the day, if a frustration is coming from a box, turn the box off. Just because there's a person at the other end of the box doesn't necessitate that you have to do anything. The second thing that drew my attention is this idea of responsibility, right? So we have the ability to choose how to respond to things. We don't always get to choose the stimulus. The stimulus might be there. It might be there because of the work situation. It might be there because of the social interaction. It might be there because it's just there. So we have no ability to control the stimulus. What hits your inbox, what hits your IMs, what hits your DMs, what pops up on your computer is largely outside of your control. How you choose to respond is absolutely within your ability and by definition is responsibility, right? Your ability to choose how to respond. And so I think understanding that once you kind of I guess it requires taking a little bit of self responsibility to say, hey, I do, if I can choose, then I'll choose differently. I think that's the first step. And that comes with somewhat of a knock because you have to admit that, well, I'm choosing to do this. I'm choosing to put myself in this situation. But how did you phrase it? You say it's lonely at the top.
Yeah, it's lonely at the top, but it sure is satisfying looking at everybody else below you.
So this is Steve's worldview. You largely view things as you find yourself to be a very reasonable, rational, logic-driven person. And so once you've arrived at whatever the answer is, if somebody else wants to disagree with that, that's fine. They're free to do so. You're just going to sit from on high and watch them wallow around in what you would describe as their ignorance, right? And so it is maybe not a friendly place to be all the time, but it's not stress-inducing. And I think I know that in the past 2-3 years, I have definitely had it's been a tremendous blessing to me to embrace this idea of just, I don't really care, man. You do you. I'm going to do me, and I'm happy to walk away. I think where that gets a little dicey is when it comes into work conflict to where it's not a function of, well, we decided ahead of time I'm not going to be here, or we decided ahead of time I'm not going to respond to this. And so I dealt with this. I've actually dealt with this a couple of times over the past few weeks to where we had a client, or actually really a collection of clients, that demanded something that is entirely unreasonable, coupled with the thing that they previously asked us to do. We did exactly the way they asked us to do it, and then they were unhappy with the end result of the process they laid out that we followed. And so it's one of those things where in the moment, my gut and my knee-jerk reaction, much like you to say, I won't let this stand, is to say, no, we did exactly what you told us to do, exactly how you told us to do it, exactly when you told us to do it. If you didn't correctly anticipate the consequences of your request, that isn't my fault. And oh, by the way, I tried to tell you. That's what I wanted to say. What I actually said was, I'm so sorry for the misunderstanding. It's absolutely my fault for not being more clear, not communicating more clearly. How can I make it better? And taking that approach did a couple of things. First of all, it softened the client because it takes it from a blah, 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 to like, oh, okay, fine. He's doing what I say. Yeah, he's admitting he's wrong. Okay, great. Awesome. All right. Yeah, I've taken the L. Now let's move on. But then the other thing it does, it opens the door to move towards a constructive solution, right? Instead of focusing on who was right, who was wrong, who said what, and going point for point, you move to finding a win, and finding the place of common ground where you can celebrate and say, okay, well, here's the place where we can all agree. So now that I understand that you wanted this and that you shouldn't have told me that, now we can move to a place of construction and move forward in a positive way. And I think just having that attitude of, I'm not concerned with my personal pride, not concerned with being right, I'm not concerned with, you know, getting one up over you, so to speak. I'm just concerned at helping you get what you want. And if you made a mistake and didn't understand, I'll just assume that that is my fault, because I will assume ignorance over malice. It wasn't that they tried to mislead. It wasn't that they tried to tank the project. It's they were ignorant and they just didn't understand. And so I can be a bigger person and say, all right, well, in your ignorance, I will help you, and I'll help you understand a better way. And I'll be the first person to help you get there now that I understand what you're actually aiming for. So I don't know if that wax eloquent is helpful to anyone per se, but I'd be interested to hear from the audience, how do you deal with conflict, particularly technological conflict, where, you know, we've started to break down these barriers. There was a time, and Steve, you were talking about this before the show, there was a time where you strolled into the office at 7:45, filled up your water bottle by the water cooler, said hi to Joe and Bob, sat down at your desk, and if there was a problem, they strolled on over and they talked to you, right? And then you had it out, or maybe you stepped into a room and had a conversation, and whatever, we all worked it out. Today, you get a message, it's salty, you respond, it's salty, it gets back and forth, it escalates, then all of a sudden, the person blocks you, or they hang up on you, or they disconnect from you, or they jump out of the room. And now there's all manner of different, you know, problems going on and all sorts of emotions flying around the room. And it's largely you're left guessing because you're not even in the same physical place.
Yeah, it's a real struggle, especially because it's a difficult subject. But my observation has been that the people who may have just started growing up with technology as opposed to have had it their entire lives, those people are less likely to do ghosting or simply just like hang up on you in terms of the like if you're on a video chat, whereas the millennials or the folks that have know nothing but technology seem to have no problem with ghosting or with just like clicking the little X on the meeting window in people right in the middle of their sentences. And because there's a disconnection or disassociation between the fact that it's a real person, because most of the communication is online. Like they haven't lived through a time when you couldn't do that. And so, that breeds new challenges, because you end up with people that are just drop, and you can fake that too, right? Oh, I had internet problems or whatever. And you're like,
That's even more insidious if you think about it, because now we've coupled passive aggressiveness with outright lying.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And it absolutely happens. And it happens in business more than you might think. It's just like, you can tell because especially some of the meeting software shows like the connection bars for people or whatever. And like, oh, this person's got full green, and all of a sudden they disappear. And like, okay, internet problems happen. 100% they happen, but it sure is convenient, the timing of that problem, like, you know, makes me a little suspicious. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think it's more challenging today for folks that have grown up with communication and they don't even realize that it's a problem, because they never learned to socialize in a fact of like, I don't know, in high school, when somebody like, if when a group of guys really didn't like what you were doing, they'd corner you and there was no way for you to hang up. Like, like that was just a thing that you had to deal with. And nowadays, like most of that communication happens online, whether it's online bullying or whatever. And there's just a different modality and mentality of like what reality is, depending on how you grew, like where and when you grew up with technology.
Why do you think it is that people are so there's one problem of people clicking the X too fast. It seems to me that the other end of the spectrum is people clicking the X too slow. They stay plugged in to their own detriment, to the point that really horrific things have happened to people because they, I want to be very careful how I phrase this, but really terrible things have happened to people because they were continued to be plugged in and either didn't know or hadn't flexed the muscle of walking away and sacrificing whatever the conversation is, whatever the argument is, whatever the debate is, whatever the thing is, for their own sanity.
So I'll give you my second book recommendation of the night. So the first one was the Master Switch. Mm-hmm. This one is called Irresistible. This is The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And that with the time winding down, we don't really have time to get into it, but that's an interesting topic that this book covers really well. But essentially, even if you hit the X, we have conditioned ourselves to go and check every two to three minutes. So like, yes, you might have gotten rid of the immediate face-to-face contact, but then you go back and check. Did I get a like? Did somebody reply? Yeah. Like, and largely, I think that is the issue here is parenting and parents not taking responsibility for the introduction of technology into people's lives. Like, it seems unfair to place that blame at parents' feet, but at the end of the day, when you're the arbiter of things coming into your house, it behooves you to understand how the stuff is causing changes in the brain, and that information has been out there for a while, and we just kind of ignored it. Like, we can see the trends of, you know, what did television do to us, what did computer use do to us, what did the computer use with the internet do to us, and that evolution, and we haven't done a good enough job as society arming parents with the ability to understand this stuff. And because of that, the children then are handed devices, which they become addicted to because there's no, the parents don't know. The parents don't realize that they're addicted to it. You know, I look around in my own family and I see device addiction. You know, it's carried in the back pocket, and the first chance that there is that there's like silence in the room, people are pulling out their phone.
Gotta check.
So I'd say, yeah, Irresistible, really good book on this topic. It's kind of an eye opener.
So here are some takeaways for you. Define and communicate your boundaries. So what can you live with? What can you not live with? Find that out ahead of time. If you work for somebody else, have that discussion with your boss. If you're the boss, have that discussion honestly. Is it going to sound really stupid and weird, but I promise you, you'll get more out of it than you think. Go stand in front of a mirror. Go stand in front of a mirror and just look for a good long time and have a nice, long, self-reflective opportunity to figure out what you can live with and what you can't. Second, look for the win. So find a way to celebrate the wins. Avoid, a wise man overlooks the insults, right? So overlook the insults and find a way to celebrate the win for the sake of the relationship. Even if you don't really care about the win, find the things that you can get most excited about. And the last thing, be willing to unplug. Exercise your walk away power. Pick, for me, it was one day a week, and that was a recommendation for Steve. It is unquestionably, well, I guess I can't give Steve entirely all of the credit, right? I guess it was probably a biblical thing before it was a Steve thing, but unequivocally changed my life. So highly recommend putting some thought into it. And again, if you have thoughts, if you struggle with this, or if you figured something out that we haven't, let us know. Hey, Scales coming up, not this coming weekend, but the weekend after. I will be there. We're going to get together for a meetup on Saturday night, as well as I will hang out with you at the conference. So if you're going to be in Pasadena, come say hi, shoot me a message on Matrix, or write into the show at live@AskNoahShow.com. We'll put something together. It's the 21st annual Southern California Linux Expo, March 14th through 17th at the Pasadena Convention Center, Pasadena, California. Music in our ears means we're out of time. See you next week.